Well, let me introduce you to Israel in about 1050 BC, approximately the date we've reached at the end of the period of the Judges. It's quite a loose federation of tribes. If we think of the Israelites at any time during the entire Old Testament period as being primarily conscious of belonging to Israel as a whole, Israel the nation, we're almost certainly mistaken. An Israelite felt his primary allegiance was first to his family and then to his tribe. And certainly at this period, any Israelite would have had a strong sense of belonging to the tribe of Manasseh or Benjamin or Gad, and the united nation of Israel hardly existed at all. These tribes, joining together from time to time for a common cause and common battles, were dominated by their enemies, the Philistines, who themselves were not a nation, but a federation of five city-states in the area shown in green on this larger map here. 1 Samuel 13 explains that the Philistines had banned all blacksmiths from Israel, so that the Israelites had to go to the Philistines to sharpen all their agricultural instruments, but principally so that the Israelites wouldn't be able to make any swords or spears. There were, in fact, large tracts of the promised land, which is broadly anything vaguely pink in the bigger map, or at least that's the heart, what I'm going to call the heartland of Israel. There were, in fact, large tracts of that under enemy occupation. And the Israelites had a respected but aging spiritual leader, Samuel, the last of the judges. Knowing that his days of offering guidance to Israel were numbered, Samuel appointed his sons as judges. But they unfortunately were ne'er-do-wells who took advantage of their position to line their own pockets. And this was part of the reason why the Israelite tribal leaders now came to Samuel and asked him for a king. In particular, they want a king to fight Israel's wars. Perhaps you turn for our first reference to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and I'll start from verse 19. The first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, then the J's, Joshua and Judges, and then the next big book is 1 Samuel. So 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 19. Here Samuel has just tried to persuade the Israelites not to have a king. But this is how they reply, verse 19. The people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, we're determined to have a king over us, so that we also may be like other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles." During the period of the Judges, Israel had no standing army and no strong central institution. This left her politically weak and vulnerable to enemy attack. It did indeed make political sense to have a king, and it's doubtful whether Israel would ever have achieved its empire under Solomon without a king. But it went against all the religious traditions of Israel, which made it very clear that God alone was their ruler. That was why Samuel opposed the move, and why God was hurt. But in the end, told Samuel to agree. You'll find both these aspects of God's reaction if you look up at chapter 8, you've got that open, and verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me from being king over them." The man God chose and told Samuel to anoint was Saul. We can't be sure of any of these early kings' dates, but they were approximately 1050 to 1010 BC. I call the initial period Saul's honeymoon. Samuel anointed Saul king first privately and then publicly before the assembled tribes of Israel. But not everyone was sure about this man from a very obscure family. And in any case, Israel had no tradition of a king. So that after the anointing, what we would call the coronation, everyone went back to their own home, except for a few warriors who joined Saul. And Saul himself went back to his farm. But when the Ammonites, who are basically in this sort of area here, when the Ammonites attacked the town of Jabesh Gilead, here just across the Jordan, just the Jordan down here, attacked the city of Jabesh Gilead, and news came to Saul as he was plowing, the Spirit of God came upon Saul in power, in great anger against the enemies of Israel. He slaughtered two oxen, cut them in pieces, and sent the pieces around the tribe, saying, whoever does not come after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. And then he won a crushing defeat against the Ammonites. This proved conclusively to the people of Israel that the Spirit of the Lord was with Saul and it won him the right to be king. Especially as Saul then followed this up with an even more striking victory against the Philistines and then against other nations. But no sooner had his reign begun than we also meet Saul's sins. Now these may seem strange and even unimportant to us, but the significant fact is that they traded obedience to God for what Saul perceived as his immediate personal advantage. The first happened before his decisive encounter with the Philistines. The Philistines had overwhelming numerical and technical superiority. Saul knew he needed the favor of God and was told by Samuel to wait for 7 days for Samuel's own arrival before offering the pre-battle sacrifices. But his army was beginning to desert, and so Saul panicked and took it into his own hands, not waiting for Samuel as commanded by God. In a later incident, God told Saul not only to attack the Amalekites, but utterly to destroy them. For their enmity to Israel when the Israelites had just escaped from Egypt at the Red Sea, Saul disobeyed. He kept alive Agag, the Amalekite king, and only destroyed the valueless animals, keeping the best of their livestock. When confronted by Samuel, Saul claimed, rather lamely, that he was going to use the animals to sacrifice to the Lord. But Samuel replied, "Surely to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." 1 Samuel 15:22 and 23. And he announced to Saul that God would look for a new king, a man after God's own heart. It isn't long before we meet Saul's paranoia. The way the Bible puts it is this: the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. the young David was sent to the court to play the lyre and soothe Saul during his demented spells. David quickly showed that he was not only a skillful musician, but a brave, innovative, and popular army commander. He was spectacularly successful, attracting crowds of adoring women who sang, "Saul has killed his thousands, and David his ten thousands." And Saul couldn't abide this. In his jealousy, he tried to kill David twice, hurling a spear at David while he was playing soothing music to him. God now completely withdrew from Saul. He'd already long since told Samuel secretly to anoint David as the new king. And the result was that the Philistines utterly defeated Israel at the Battle of Mount Gilboa, which is there. This is a plain that actually quite important to understand the geography of Israel. Basically, the geography of Israel is divided into five parts. There's a coastal plain, then there is a mountain strip, then there's a valley of the Jordan, and a further parallel mountain strip further to the east. But there is a valley, this valley here, it's called here the Valley of Jezreel or the Valley of Esdraelon, which bisects the mountain chain in the north and the mountain chain in the south. Israel was most at home in the mountains. The Philistines, with their chariots, most at home in the plains. So it was very foolish of Israel to meet the Philistines at the foot of Mount Gilboa, which is in this plain of Jezreel, giving the Philistines the advantage. So as I say, they were utterly defeated, the Israelites were, at that battle. Saul committed suicide, three of his sons were killed. And Israel's first experiment with a king had shown considerable initial success, but ended in disaster. Israel's next king, however, was her greatest ever, David, who reigned from approximately 1010 to 970 BC. He too had a honeymoon. A honeymoon period in his later teens and early 20s. Probably had several honeymoons after that, actually, because he married innumerable wives. We'll come on to that in a moment. Fairly early in Saul's reign, God told Samuel to anoint David as king in a secret meeting just of David's family. And as soon as he was anointed, I quote, "The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward." Much the same had happened to Saul straight after his anointing by Samuel. The difference was that God rapidly withdrew his spirit from Saul. The spirit remained with David. An early evidence of this was David's remarkable victory over Goliath. And 1 Samuel 18 sums up, "David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him." The Lord continued to be with him. But that doesn't stop the fact that the next period sees David on the run. 13 chapters in the Bible, 1 Samuel 19 to 31, and probably most of David's mid and later 20s. King Saul, as we've seen, was so jealous of David that he was after his blood. It meant that David had constantly to move from place to place to avoid capture, eventually taking refuge with the hated Philistines as a protege of Achish, king of Gath, which is here, one of the five Philistine towns. During this time, David gathered around him a group of dissidents and ruffians, some of whom were the future commanders and daredevils of his army. David was never long away from military action and continued during this time to make raids on Israel's enemies. It was his final hosts, the Philistines, who defeated Israel so drastically at the battle I've already mentioned, the Battle of Mount Gilboa. And with Saul's death, David becomes king of Judah. King, that is, of just one tribe, his own tribe, the tribe of Judah. David by now is 30, and on Saul's death, he's anointed king with his capital right at the heart of the territory of Judah at Hebron, right down in the south of the Israelite heartland. Meanwhile, Ishbael, one of Saul's sons, was made king of the rest of Israel with his capital at Mahanaim, which is somewhere here. As you can see, it's got a question mark after it. We don't know exactly where it was. It was certainly east of the Jordan. And the fact that it was east of the Jordan is probably due to the fact that most, if not all, of Israel's heartland to the west of the Jordan was at this time under Philistine control. Almost immediately, war broke out between Israel under Ishbael and Judah under David. As 2 Samuel 3:1 puts it, David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. So that before long, David was king of all Israel. Two of Ishbael's officers murdered him, and all the tribes of Israel came together to anoint David king at Hebron. Hebron was too far south to be the capital of the whole of the combined tribes, and too closely associated with the tribe of Judah. So David captured Jerusalem here, which was still in native Jebusite hands, and moved his capital there. The heart of it, Zion, became known as the City of David, showing that it owed allegiance to him and his conquering of it, and not to any of the individual tribes. And to give this new capital of the kingdom added validity and preeminence, David brought the Ark of the Covenant, the most holy symbol of God's presence, into Jerusalem itself. With his base now secure, David spent the early and middle part of his reign in conquering surrounding nations. The Philistines, Moabites, Zobah, Damascus, and Edomites. So that the Israelite Empire not only contained the heartland of Israel, roughly on this smaller map, the land coloured dark red, which as you will see is almost identical to the land of any shade of pink or red on the big map, but also the area in this sort of darker pink, and the area in lighter pink here and here, and even taking his influence right up to the river Euphrates, which is running along there. A vast empire, certainly by Israelite standards. David was a warrior, but he was also a deeply God-centered man. And so we turn to David, the worshipper of Israel's God. Just as in the Bible there are four versions of the life of Jesus, four Gospels, so there are two histories of the Israelite kings. The books of Samuel, with their continuance in the books of Kings, and the parallel accounts in the books of Chronicles. The writer of Chronicles is especially interested in the temple and its worship. And it's he, therefore, who particularly brings out David's interest in worship, though it's certainly there in 1 and 2 Samuel as well. David wants to build God a house, a temple. God certainly commends the desire, but nevertheless refuses because, I quote, "You have shed much blood and waged great wars." 1 Chronicles 22:8 and 28:3. Thus showing, incidentally, that the Old Testament, though at one level it marvels at its greatest king's victories, also knows that all warfare is fundamentally abhorrent to God, though sometimes necessary. But if David is not to be allowed to build the temple because he's shed too much blood, he's determined to make arrangements for the worship of Israel so that it will be central to the life of his kingdom. He organizes the duties of priests and Levites, including not only the priests with their sacrifices and teaching role, but the singers, musicians, gatekeepers, and treasurers. He makes full preparations for the temple, passing on to Solomon the plans that God has given him, and collecting the necessary precious raw materials. And, of course, David writes psalms, devotional songs for his own use and for use in the temple. But sadly, there is also a dark side to David's character. And I call this David's uncontrolled loves. Some modern commentators have tried to make out that David was a homosexual, specifically in his very close relationship with Saul's son, Jonathan. But in fact, David was a man to whom the love of women had almost always meant a lot from his earliest days, and his first downfall was his adulterous love for Bathsheba, which ended, you remember, in his murder of her husband Uriah, her losing the baby of the adulterous union, and God's verdict, which it would be worth turning to in 2 Samuel chapter 12. This is 2 Samuel now, chapter 12. And I'm going to read verses 10 to 12. Because although we know in Psalm 51 David's prayer of penitence and God's forgiveness of him, still, as often with sin, there is a punishment which continues. "Now, says God," verse 10, "therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, I will raise up trouble against you from within your own house, and I will take your wives from before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this very sun, for you did it secretly. But I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." Trouble against you from within your own house. That was exactly what happened. Partly because of God's direct judgment on David for his adultery and murder, and partly because of David's overindulgent love of his children. Listen to this about how he was quite incapable of disciplining them. 1 Kings 1:6. His father, that's David, had never displeased Adonijah by asking, "Why have you done thus and so?" He never called him up short and asked him any questions. Now you might have thought, if you didn't know human nature as well as I'm sure you do, that they would be grateful for his never checking them. But the more he gave, the more they wanted. And the result was full-scale rebellions. First by his son Absalom, which resulted in David's fleeing from Jerusalem, and as the prophecy I've just read predicted, Absalom's publicly sleeping with David's concubines in order to claim royal authority, and then by another son, Adonijah. David died an old man with the kingdom seriously weakened and fatally divided along the old tribal lines. Israel now needed a strong king, and they were given one in Solomon, whose approximate dates are 970 to 930. The Old Testament presents Solomon principally in four ways. First, Solomon the Wise. Early on, God appeared to him and invited him to ask for whatever he wanted. He asked the Lord not for long life, or riches, or victory over his enemies, but for an understanding mind to govern your people. God gave him vast wisdom, a wisdom that, in accordance with international thought in those days, included not only an ability to judge astutely, but, as 1 Kings 4:29 to 34 show, to compose proverbs and songs, and to have a wide knowledge of natural history. Solomon's wisdom spread far and wide, and many people came to listen to it and marvel at it, most famously the Queen of Sheba. I'm now about 4 minutes off, are you coffee people? Second, Solomon the Wealthy. As we've seen, he inherited from his father David a very considerable empire. And despite some battles, he remained the largely peaceful ruler of it, receiving tribute from his subject peoples. He was not a warrior, but a trader, trading horses and chariots over land, and with the help of Hiram, king of Tyre, building a merchant navy. For the first time in Israel, Israelites don't much like the sea, and importing, I quote from 1 Kings 10:22, gold, silver, ivory, apes and peacocks. Third, we find Solomon the Builder. Above all, he built the temple. And this takes up about half of the chapters, chapters 5 to 9, in the account of his life in the book of Kings. The temple, as we shall see after the break, was absolutely crucial for Israel. Israel had no statue of her God, and she knew perfectly well that God lived in heaven. He's too holy to live on earth. Nevertheless, it was Solomon's hope and prayer in 1 Kings 8 that God would associate himself clearly and irrevocably with the temple, that his presence would be quite specifically there. Please turn to 1 Kings 9, that's straight after 2 Samuel, to see God's answer to Solomon's prayer. He says, 1 Kings 9, verse 3, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built, and put my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. Wonderful, wouldn't it, if God could say that about our new building when we open it? So Solomon is remembered by Israel as the great builder of the temple, the symbol of God's presence among his people. The temple is that. He was also a great builder of secular buildings, both of his own palace and of many Israelite cities and strongholds outside Jerusalem. You can still see much of his building work in archaeological digs today. But Solomon also had his dark side. And particularly towards the end of his life, we find Solomon the backslider. At the outset of his reign, we are told Solomon loved the Lord, 1 Kings 3:3. But now he married many women from nations that God had outlawed as far as intermarriage was concerned. He began to worship their gods with them, as 1 Kings 11:5 puts it. Solomon followed Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. He built worship places for them too. And God's verdict was this: I will surely tear the kingdom from you, and I will give only one tribe to your son. And how that happened, we shall hear next week.